Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And how are you, man? How's everything?
It's actually still the same bullshit going on. My knees
still
all
on crutches.
Up. Mm-hmm. I took the brace off. I'm just waiting on another MRI to go through. And to start physical therapy, but workers' comp's dragging.
Yeah, well, don't they always? So, yeah. Well, you know what's going to be fun is, fans of the locker room who've listened to Matt have known that his shoulder hurts because he has a torn rotator cuff. And so we found out that on the day that we're supposed to record the next episode of Locker Room, he's having shoulder surgery. So the cool thing is we've decided to do it right after his surgery so we can get him hopped up on his pain meds. So that'll be fun.
that's always awesome. Give him some alcohol too.
Yeah. So longtime listeners of the show and fans of the show who are not longtime listeners but went back and listened to our entire back catalog will recognize a voice. We have a young man with us who previously went by Breacher when we were using nicknames, and now he's here with us. What's up, William? How are you?
What's going on, guys? How's everybody doing?
Oh man, I'm just living the dream with my eyes open, you know. So we're glad to have you back. Last time you were on here to remind people, if you can, kind of what your background is. You have some experience both in law enforcement and in the medical field.
Yeah, correct. So a long time EMT. I did that. I started out there with AMR pretty much right out of high school and did that for a few years, and then I got picked up with a sheriff's department in California, and I've been there since. I think I'm coming up on 8 years now that I've been with them, and held a variety of assignments, patrolling a lot of different areas. I was a detective for 3 years or so, and now I just actually promoted to a new spot that we refer to as a senior deputy. So now I'm back out on the street and living and learning, man.
You get to have the trainees in your car now, and you have to like dome the ropes now.
No, dude. So our department's like, it's a very unique structure compared to pretty much everything else in California. So the trainees, they go with field training officers. And then we have, we actually have two supervisor spots per squad per area. So, where you guys are probably used to the supervisor being a sergeant. Yeah. That is in true for us, but we also have an additional supervisor that's underneath
the field supervisor,
the senior deputy spot. So that's the position that I'm in now. And, it's been pretty bitching so far. A lot of responsibility with admin and all that other stuff that I wasn't used to, but now, it's cool to be able to kind of run around and, learn from the different guys I got on the squad, and then also try and help, teach them some things from what I've been taught before. So
yeah, our department was similar. We had a senior officer cause we were, mm-hmm. city, all seniors, all two stripers are required to be field training officers. So you can have a field training officer who is a slick sleeve if they, show themselves worthy. And, I had a friend who was a training officer, but he didn't want to promote to senior officer because to quote him, first place in a cocksucking contest is still a cocksucker. So he never wanted to promote.
oh, wow.
But he was a great training officer, let me tell you. So we were the same way. We had two stripers called senior officers, and all the two stripers were required to be FTOs, but not all FTOs were two stripers.
Yeah, I still am technically an FTO, but after my stint in detectives, I'm pretty sure I need a lot of refreshers or something to get back up on that horse. I'm not sure, but
probably.
I got a couple guys on my squad now that are FTOs, so hopefully that'll kind of lessen the burden as far as me having to take anybody as a trainee right off the bat. But it's a good time.
Yeah, right. I actually enjoyed having trainees because I always felt like you could actually make a difference in cops that you eventually had to work with.
I like having trainees that were good trainees.
Well, yeah, like of course.
Trainees that were flaps.
Yeah, and when you have a bad trainee, it's there's nothing worse, man.
Well, I just want to become a training officer. That'd be great.
Are you still on training?
What? We're frozen right now.
Yeah, you guys shit. And you guys probably have a whole different system for it too as well.
Yeah, what you guys are talking about is completely like foreign to me. We just you know, officers, field training officers, supervisors, that's it. Yep. I mean,
so just a quick sidebar. I'm not sure we'll probably talk about more of this later, but we're currently in the works right now of designing a shirt specifically for you guys that says "Make Overtime Great Again."
Okay, that's good. Actually, that's a good segue. You want to talk about it?
So the wife and I have started, it's primarily hers. I kind of am more of an advisor for some of the marketing and business side of it. But the wife started a company that is called Babes and Bullets Co. It's a apparel company for both men and women. We offer all kinds of different t-shirts, joggers, tank tops, hats, coffee cups. I mean, you're run-of-the-mill type of apparel. But it's kind of unique in the sense that it's all first responder based. So we have a lot of thin blue line. We have a lot of thin red line. We've got a thin green line for the military. And then we also have just your normal designs that, you know, don't necessarily reflect any type of first responder apparel, so that for those of the people that, you know, don't feel comfortable wearing it, whatever it may be.
Yeah, it's patriotic kind of 2A Second Amendment type supporter really cool. Stuff instead of like blasting out, no, I'm a cop or I'm a firefighter.
Right, totally. So, and on top of that, it's, you know, we wanted to have this outlet where we were able to support not only the guys and girls that like we work with, but also everybody nationwide. It came kind of from this time frame, like after George Floyd, when you really started to see this country start to divide, right? We had a lot of people that were just totally pro law enforcement. And then we had the other side of the aisle where it was complete, obviously, anarchy. And in that sense, it, you know, how else can we really, besides going out and thanking others and you know, working as hard as we can to make sure the community's safe, what other outlets could we get into as far as my contributions from my family? And that's where we came up with the idea. You know, my wife was like, hey, I think I want to start this business. And she's like, I'm going to name it Babes and Bullets. And I was all, son of a bitch, dude. How did she think of that? And I didn't. What the hell? Like, that's perfect.
Yeah, that's because our wives are always smarter than we are.
Oh, man. So, you know, she took some of her skills to use. And when she wanted to finally get serious about it, we took about 6 months to start building things up. And then we finally went live, and I was actually sitting right here where I am now when we decided to get the website live and everything. And I had a couple buddies over, let the kids play. And I was like, oh yeah, we'll go live today. Let's just see kind of how it goes. I thought it was going to be, you know, almost startups are right. Like pretty slow and nothing crazy. And I don't think I went to bed that night until about 4:30 in the morning because of all the interaction that we were doing and orders. And it just took off, dude. It was insane. And
that's good.
Yeah, we were super thankful for it. So that actually gave us the ability to start growing the business. And we got more designs in. We started kind of moving into different directions as far as the apparel goes. Like at first, you know, it was like, hey, let's make some t-shirts and call it good. And now it's, you know, we have everything across the board, like I was explaining before. And we actually have a pretty solid direction of where we want to go with the company as time progresses. And then on top of that, we have it set up now where every first responder related purchase that we do. So we've got some stuff coming out soon for nurses. We got some stuff coming out for dispatchers, EMTs, paramedics, you name it. We're going to have some type of line available to every aspect of being a first responder. And every sale that we do from that, we have multiple different charities that we donate at the end of the month, a portion of all the sales to those charities. So for example, we've got this new organization that is a law enforcement fund for basically catastrophically injured officers or downed officers' families. And the organization is called Cover Now. And they're based out of the Los Angeles area. I believe it's a few LAPD coppers that are running it. And it's a super bitchin' organization. They're newer towards the foundation. And you know, part of us was like, okay, well, we can contribute to something like, you know, the Officer Down Memorial page. But realistically, you know, those guys, our donors, in my opinion, you know, like our donations that we would be able to make based upon sales to them could probably be equivalent to, you know, 25 cents of a, you know, compared to what I can donate to Cover Now, which is a newer organization. And, you know, we're able to give them hundreds of dollars at the end of the month and help support them, help support other law enforcement. And
for sure,
so for that, it's pretty bitching. So we've got them, we've got the Widows and Orphans Fund for the fire department. And then we're working right now on finding some for different hospitals and EMT and paramedics nationwide, things like that. So, yeah.
Well, I love the Make Overtime Great Again. That's an awesome shirt. And if you want to get it, head over to babesandbullets.com. Is that the URL?
Babesandbulletsco.com. So, yeah, the middle in between Babes and Bullets is the letter N, not the word and.
Yeah, so. N is in Nora. And then... co.com.
You can also find us on Instagram. That's kind of our biggest outreach plate.
So you guys do crop tops?
We do.
Need any male models?
I mean, if you're interested, I think we could work something.
Might as well.
Yeah. So
yeah, the floor is yours. What is your story?
And kind of prepping for today's episode, it was funny because I was talking to some of my partners at work. And you know, when we did this the first go around, we had that major incident that we were discussing earlier. And, you know, that was kind of an easier way. It's like, oh, well, yeah, you want me to come and give a story? No problem. We can talk about that, you know. And then over the last 2.5, almost 3 years, I'd worked in this unit that's it's pretty badass. It's basically for us, it's our, you know, narcs, vice, human trafficking. And then we have a cannabis team. And then we have an AB-109 team. And I was on the AB-109 team. But in doing
now for that, the listeners, what's AB-109?
So AB-109 is an assembly bill that was drafted back in 2011 by Jerry Brown to kind of handle quote unquote prison overcrowding, where
Governor Moonbeam.
Yeah. So basically, just to summarize a long, complicated assembly bill, basically he got in trouble for prison overcrowding, and his catch-all, fix-all for that was, oh, okay, well, we'll just release everybody. And we'll make anybody that's a non-serious, a non-sexual, or a non-violent felon, they can just go back to the street. But they're going to be monitored by county probation instead of parole. And that's anybody released from prison. The downside to that is that's not how it works at all. I'd say 90% of my caseload was on for assault with a deadly weapon, which how that's not, you know, serious or violent, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, it's about, right there so in the name, assault with a deadly weapon. The name itself is violent.
My favorite was the guys that had, you know, prison sentences for felony domestic violence, and then they get released, and you're all, oh, yeah, he's nonviolent, but it literally says domestic violence. Okay, that checks out.
Right.
Okay. So, but yeah, so my responsibilities when I was on that team was, you know, we assist probation with, we have a couple of probation officers assigned to our unit, and then we go out, we do probation searches, check up on people, we follow intel and work, you know, work up the cases that involve our guys. And then on top of that, anybody that, you know, starts to get on the run, they get a felony warrant, and then it's our job to basically track these guys down, kind of wherever they are in the United States, and bring them back in so that they, you know, can get their warrant handled. So, yeah, in this time, and we got to do a lot of freaking cool shit. It was
yeah, that sounds like a fun team.
It was a good time. But a lot of it too, on the flip side of that, it was like, okay, well, what can we, like, what could I come in here and talk about? You know what I mean? That's not overly complicated or can't talk about it for special reasons, et cetera.
Right.
So, yeah, I kind of struggled with finding a good story here, but there was some pretty interesting events that had occurred that I'm going to kind of keep relatively simple just for the sake of how it went through. But basically it started out, I want to say probably a year and a half ago, I'd say give or take a few months, but we'd received a phone call from our sergeant at the time. And I was at home laying in bed about to kind of pass out and get a phone call as we do all the time. And they're like, hey, mount up. We've got information that a panga boat is coming in.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. So for us, for those of you that don't know, like a panga boat is usually the boats that are coming up from places like Mexico, loaded down with either drugs or people or whatever it is. And they basically take a 4 or 5 day adventure up through the ocean, come up to the United States, crash a beach somewhere, and then spread out like wildfire and run.
Yeah. Imagine if you're living in a coastal community, imagine a boat that has no business being on the ocean, traveling up the coast of the United States from Mexico, completely off the radar because it's so small and so hard to track and so hard to spot. And then they can just land it on a beach somewhere, anywhere that's completely unoccupied, ditch the boat and take whatever they had with them ashore, be that people, be that drugs, or be that a thermonuclear device.
Right. So, and for me, it was kind of interesting because, you know, you see, you know, some of the shit on TV or, you know, movies or something like that. And then you get that phone call and be like, oh, okay, well, this is kind of could be potentially legit. And on the flip side of that too, like there's a lot of times that, you know, we'll get called in for a panga boat and then that thing just never comes. And so right. We're sitting there for hours, days, whatever it may be. And it just never happens. And you're like, okay, well, so I remember when I got the phone call, I was like, well, heck yeah, I'm going to come in because this sounds awesome. But on the flip side, it's probably going to be a big nothing, you know? And so we get up there and I, you know, hauled ass into work and go and meet with everybody in the command post. And the cool part is when you have these type of operations, it's not a local level deal. This is a federal, generally a federal case. So you've got guys from FBI, Customs and Border Patrol, trying to think who else was there. We had multiple different agencies up from the local level that came out. Excuse me. And then I think we also, if I remember correctly, I think we dealt with HSI, the Homeland Security. So you have all these different people that are kind of rolling through so that we can try and apprehend this boat. The beginning of all of this was painstakingly long. We get called in. The hours that we are there, it basically turns into a surveillance operation for hours on end and days on end, really. I think we ended up being there a total of 5 or 6 days amongst the entire unit, splitting up as much as we could as far as surveillance goes. And for those of you that don't know, surveillance is pretty dang boring.
Yeah.
When you don't know what you're looking for and you're just sitting there waiting for something to happen and nothing is really happening yet. So,
right.
But we get in there and we set up surveillance and we're doing that for multiple days. We're back and forth kind of on it. And then eventually this.
Now, was it a 24-hour surveillance?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. So initially we all came in at once and then, you know, you guys know how these kind of operations go. It's like, oh yeah, well, we have this information that they're coming right now. Like it's about to go down.
Yeah. Hurry and up then, and wait.
Yeah. A few hours go by and they're like, ah, they may not be coming today. Might be tomorrow. So, right. You know, we'll have to hold it and then we'll see. And then next thing you know, it's like, okay, well now we're back on a basically like a 12 on 12 off type deal, where we would split the team up and we'd have our guys do surveillance for this one. And then, you know, they'd get relieved for the night shift or vice versa, whatever it may be. And then once we finally get actionable intelligence that we're going to act on, the whole world's obviously coming. So, we got set up. We're dealing with all these feds and multiple different people, and they're talking about different things. And we're sitting there just kind of waiting. And then, like I said, after multiple days, we finally start to get some movement at some different areas of where we thought this thing might come. And some of that movement was we started to get traffic in the middle of the night to these beaches, and we were able to, utilizing some of the technology, like we're able to kind of have the God's eye up in the sky and see what is really going on at real time out on the beach. And we're just sitting back kind of at a command post watching on TV. And so we're watching these guys come in, do their thing, and start setting up for what looks like a potential boat landing. And we give them their time, do that. They get everything done. And then we're like, all right, well, boat's coming. We got people here. They're waiting to accept this thing. And we're going to be waiting for this boat. And hours and hours and hours go by again, and nothing happens. They pack up and leave. And we're like, well, what the hell was that? Like, that didn't make any sense.
Right.
So
that's another part of surveillance that people don't understand, is trying to do analysis on what you're seeing happen in front of you and adjust your plan accordingly, because you don't know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. You know what they're supposed to be doing, but you have to kind of interpret. And that's where, like, you know, you talk about CIA analysts or intel analysts or military intelligence. That's what you do. You watch behavior. You look for things that are out of the ordinary, and then you try and make a plan as to what you're guessing is going to happen next.
Right. Well, and that, and then on top of that too, it's like, you know, the hardest part for us is it, you know, you start to see movement and things along this line, and you ramp yourself up a little bit. You're like, okay, cool. This is about to happen. Like, I am ready to go. Like, guys are starting to mount up, you know, get all their kits on, and we're getting things going. And then it's just a whole big nothing. Right. And then you're like, well, shit, now what? So we call them the landing crew. So the landing crew ends up basically, like I said, they ended up leaving. And, on the way out, we do kind of like a ruse type of traffic stop, where we stop this car, and I forget the actual number of people in it, but it was a large vehicle. But let me just say that it was well over capacity of what should have been in the
car. Right.
And you know, so we do this traffic stop, and we go up, we contact, and we make it look super simple. Like, hey, you know, we stopped you for whatever the violation was.
Yeah, you have a tail light out, right?
Yeah. And the whole point of it is kind of just to try and figure out who those people were and figure out if they were actually associated with what we were doing. And ultimately they were. And the best part about this thing was, like, we were just trying to kind of just make it real quick, right? Get in, get some info, get the heck out, and let them go on their way. And that's our plan. And so we stop on the side of the freeway. We've got a couple of units. We do that. We get in, we get some info real quick, and then we're about to get out. And the next thing you know, here comes the highway patrol, and they pull up on us. And we're like, oh, shit. So we're like, well.
And they're like, you can't let this car go. There's too many people in it.
Oh, 100%. So, that, so they pull up, and they're like, well, you know, what's going on? And I'm like, oh, you know, nothing. Just truck stop. We're good. We're all good. You guys can bounce. Like, you know, we're going to send them on their way. And then, like, the guy looks over my shoulder and just sees this basically clown car packed full of people.
He's like, no, we're going to impound it.
Well, I mean, it's like a freaking felony for them. So they're like, this is not okay. We can't be rolling that like that. And I'm all, listen, I'm telling you right now, they are fine. We are leaving. Get in your car and drive away. And the guy's like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with it. I'm all, it's our stop. Thanks for the help. We're all good. Let's just send them on their way. So they do, they leave, and we send the guy on their way. And so then we all kind of go back and meet, and we're talking with the feds are talking with us, and they're kind of at the point now where I don't think they even had faith in the fact that this, you know, boat was supposed to come any longer. So they're like, well, you know what, you guys just take it. If it comes, it'll be your guys' case. You guys handle it. And we're like,
now real quick, before you go on with the, cause the feds are handing it over to you, I want to go back, cause I know there might be people sitting here asking, why didn't you just tell the highway patrol what you were doing? And then there wouldn't be a question. They would just leave. Right. So I'll leave it to you. you explain why, when it comes to conducting operations like that, when another agency or even your own agency random patrol officer shows up, you don't just tell them?
Yeah, so it's not anything along the lines of, you know, like there's a lack of trust, or we don't, you know, think that all cops should be on the same page or anything along those lines. It's not in that aspect. And I feel like a lot of people kind of feel that way sometimes. But generally, when you work in the unit that I worked in, there's a lot that we just don't disclose with other people for the fact of any type of like accidental breach as far as the intelligence goes or the security in the operation. So, you know, and that's even long after the case is even done. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, it's kind of similar to, you know, working spec ops overseas or something like that. You know, you talk to some of those guys that come back that were on a team or something like that, and you're like, oh, well, what'd you do? And they're like, can't talk about it.
Operational security. And I've said that, you know, when you're standing there as a patrol cop and you're having a cup of coffee in a 7-Eleven or something with another patrol cop, and you guys start shooting the breeze and swapping war stories, inevitably you might say, oh, hey, so yeah, I just pulled up on a T-stop, and it was such and such agency, and they were investigating this, and it was pretty cool, because cops like to talk about that kind of stuff, but you never know who's listening.
Right. And that's the biggest thing is it, like I said, it's not gonna, I don't want to say it's never happened, because it has happened, but I'm not gonna say that like it's because I don't trust the cop. It's just the issue of that, you know, if, like you said, if you're at Starbucks and you're sitting there telling your partner about this op, and then the guy behind you is, you know, somehow related to someone who knows someone, and the phone calls start going, you know, that could jeopardize the entire operation. So,
well, and I'll tell you a true story. When I worked dope, we had a secretary that was assigned to our task force, provided by one of the local agencies. So she was an employee of one of the local police agencies, a civilian employee, and she had a secret drug problem, and she was giving out dope information on the sly. And we had an operation compromised because our damn secretary had a drug problem we didn't know about. So it happens. It does happen. So the feds decide, okay, screw it, you guys can have it. And they turn it over to you if anything happens, and then what?
So, well, then we said, okay, well, we'll continue to run with this, and let's just see kind of how it goes. So my personal thing, I was kind of worried that we might have jeopardized our own op by even doing that traffic stop in the beginning anyway.
Because yeah, that's a risk.
If I was a criminal and I was doing what they were doing, and then on my way out of there, I get pulled over by the police, I'd probably be like, something feels wrong here. Like, absolutely. Whether it be bad juju or, you know, whatever it may be. But lo and behold,
they catch the stupid ones.
Yeah, no kidding. But so yeah, lo and behold, they end up coming back the next night.
No shit. And,
so we're kind of right back to square one with what we were doing before. And we start watching them, and then we're all at this point, I think it was a little bit less like, for lack of a better term, it was a little bit less like, oh, this is going to be awesome. Like, let's hit it. Like this time we were like, okay, well now what the hell are they doing? And so everybody was a little bit more lax, a little bit more calm. Everybody wasn't racing to get their kits on, all that. So I remember we were sitting at a command post, and we were kind of just waiting and watching on the TV. Like I went and grabbed a folding chair and just put that out, and was like, all right, I'll sit here and hang out until, you know, someone tells me I need to do something.
Right.
And short time after that, the phone call comes in, and they're all, hey, boat's coming, and it's going to be landing within probably 10 minutes.
Wow.
So then we went from, yeah. So then we went from, okay, well, we'll have time. Cause you know, normally they give you, you know, they'll pick it up or whatever, and they'll be like, okay, well, we've got some time that, you know, we can get ready for it and all that. And we didn't have that opportunity. So we jumped in real quick. And I mean, you've got fully kitted dudes and everything you can think of sitting in pickup beds and all that. And we disperse out to go do the op, right? So the initial mindset too was, okay, well, there's two ways that we can do this. We know it's coming. We know that there's probably some type of controlled substances on board. We can either intercept upon them landing at the beach, and then we have to be the ones to carry whatever's on that boat all the way up, or we'll sit back, give them some time, let them load everything up.
Exactly.
And then once they load everything up, then we'll move in. And so it was a kind of an interesting way that we went about it, but
work smart, not hard.
Right. So we basically let them start packing everything that they were doing. And as soon as they made it in, the location that they chose was perfect in the eyes of law enforcement, because there was one way in and one way out. And so it was actually a relatively simple plan that we had conducted, where as soon as we knew that the thing was going to start moving, we were going to just flood the area. So we thought, right?
Never
worked out his plan.
Yeah, but exactly.
So we go over and we see them start loading everything up. The van starts to leave and we're like, okay, let's go. Move, move, move. So we go down and light up the street, shut it down. Driver's compliant. We get him all locked in. But the problem was, the only guy in the van at that point was one dude. The other 20 something people saw the lights on the main road and then took off. And luckily we kind of simultaneously worked this out to where we stopped the van, but then it was like storming the beach of Normandy with a bunch of cops as far as how the rest of it played out, because that was the trigger point. And the next thing you know, it was almost like a movie scene. It's like lights come on, dude freaks out, stops. Next thing you know, there's helicopters coming over this hillside, you know, night suns everywhere. Guys are coming over. Everybody's, you know, kitted up, and the clown chase is on at that point. It's just, you know, everybody's
running. Cue the Benny Hill music.
Mm-hmm. And so we go out, we start doing our searches and trying to, you know, get a bunch of people into custody. And we're basically working along a cliffside and the beach. And I forget the total number of people that we ended up apprehending, but it took hours basically we locked it down tight, but getting over that hillside and then trying to find people in, you know, the dark of night in an area that we don't normally go traverse. And, you know, we're just basically going from bush to bush, shaking out, literally shaking the bushes to see.
Right. Right. We always say, oh, you got to beat the bushes, but you were actually beating the bushes.
Do you have dogs out there?
What's that?
Did you have dogs out there?
Canine? We did. We did. And they were utilized.
Good.
So we ended up. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, with that, there was definitely, I mean, just like any operation you do, you know what I mean? You come back and then you debrief and then you start to learn that there's some things that we could have done better. There's things that, you know, went great. There's things that we could work on, et cetera. And so I think that was part of it was a learning experience for us and them, because normally when a canine deploys, you know, we have some type of team where it's, you know, three guys, four guys with a canine officer, where that way the handler can focus solely on his dog and their mission, but he's got three or four dudes surrounding him to protect him, you know, with long rifles or at least handguns or whatever. Yeah. And
right.
The way that this played out, it where we normally have a pretty structured, you know, entry team, react team, whatever it may be. If you're hitting a house, you know, it's generally a smaller confined space where, you know, this entry team is going to go inside the interior of the house and conduct a search, and we'll try and find people or, you know, whatever it may be. And that's something we can manage relatively easily, right? When you have this massive area that, yeah, we had it locked down per se, but, you know, you can't just line five guys up at the front door and then be like, all right, breach, 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 let's go. And start moving in and have a systematic search. So everybody kind of started to take off anything that, you know, they would bite off anything they could chew. And the next thing you know, we've got canine handlers with dogs that are by themselves. And I mean, everybody kind of at that point was spread out, and we were trying to keep it at least in teams of two so that we would have a good offset there. But you know how it gets chaotic, and, you know, people start getting pulled every different which way. And
right. So your first order of business is to catch the runners, right?
Right.
Because you can see them. And then once you catch the runners, you're like, okay, how many people are we missing? So now it becomes, it's almost like when you're going into, let's say, active shooter. I'll use that for an example because I think people can wrap their heads around it. If the shooting is going on, you have a direction to go. You have something to pursue. So again, in your situation, if somebody's running from you, you have someone to pursue. But when it goes from active to static or passive, you know, and now it's just like, okay, we got to find people that are hiding. So now we have to slow down, be methodical, and you've already got all your resources spread out from chasing these people all over hell and creation. So it's like regroup, reassess, and start kind of over.
Right. Well, and the hard part about it too is, you know, once you kind of get to that calm down point, I don't know how else to describe it, that point where it's like, okay, we've got, you know, X amount of people in custody. We've done a pretty thorough search and we haven't found anybody else. You know, guys will start kind of falling back to wherever we're staging the in custodies. And then from there, it's like, there's a lot more involved with that when that occurs. So like, you know, the feds come in, Homeland Security has to start getting involved. So now they're doing everything they need to do.
Then, oh, so they came back?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. As soon as this thing came back to fruition, all of a sudden they were like, oh, hey, just kidding. We're here. Sorry.
No, we want to know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I'm in no way saying that in a disparaging way. I'll tell you what, look, some of those dudes are some badass operators, man, and some good people. There's a head guy there that we've dealt with on a few different bases, and the guy he's legit, man. You know, it's funny looking at it from like a tactical standpoint, and you look at the comparison of like local to state to feds, and you know, we're like, okay, well, hey, we need to do this, you know, kind of methodically. I don't want to say slow because it really wasn't slow, but it needs to be methodical and go. And then you've got like some of these feds, dude, and the boat's like coming into the water and they're just rushing the boat, dude. They're going straight for it. Like, you're like, oh, okay, well, there they go.
Yeah. So tell us about that. So your tactics and the feds' tactics sound like they were markedly different, but also it sounds like the feds had their own boat.
No, the feds were with us.
Okay.
But I think their ideology is a little bit different than ours, where, you know, for us, especially in this type of capacity, this is going to be something that's, we're basically there to provide strength in numbers for their case, right? So we're there to help them out. And the way that our department operates, and it's kind of on the West Coast, it's kind of a very similar all the way across the board. You know, you have your few departments that are very much so still Wild West, but for the most part, we all generally kind of operate in that slow things down, analyze what you have in front of you, develop a plan, and then execute the plan.
Right.
And right. So when that, especially in the unit that I was in where we did a lot of warrant services, you know, that's like in essence a bread and butter type thing. You know what I mean? It's everything we do is like, slow it down, figure out what's going on. We own this now. Let's get it handled appropriately. Right. And then, you know, you've got different agencies that it's a different way of life, man, for those guys. And so, you know, we're like, hey, you know, in our minds, we're like, well, nobody's going to go storm the boat. We need to just, you know, get in and then start trying to get these guys safely to where we're not going to jeopardize anything there. And then on the flip side of that, there's guys that from, you know, the Fed side that were like, boat's here, Leroy, we're gone.
Jenkins. And then they just 100%. Rush it.
100%.
Yeah. And hey, you know what? Different mentality sometimes. It can vary from agency to agency. It can vary. Like I've seen, you know, other agencies show up on scenes where I'm handling it for them until they show up. And I'm like, you know, locking it down, getting real methodical, doing my thing. And they show up and they just like a bull in a china shop. They just ram things with cars and toss stuff, you know. I've seen chippies literally like take an overturned car with stolen property spilling out of it and just ram it right off the freeway. And they don't give a crap about the stolen property. They give a crap about opening up that lane of traffic.
Right.
So different priorities, different mindsets, all that stuff affects it.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's one of those things where it's almost like a balance, you know what I mean? Because something they're doing may not be the same policy as what we're functioning off of. So it's like, okay, well, you know, how involved can I personally get in my you know, adventure here? Or what do I need to like take a step back and think of, you know, that longer kind of term effects and be like, okay, well, that's fine if they want to do that. I'm going to go ahead and just provide cover from here or whatever right. it may be. So there's a lot of adjusting on the fly. And I think that was something that made it even that much more worthwhile. You know, absent what we already had did, what we got off the boat and all that. I can't get into what we got off the boat and all that, but it was big and it was legit. But
nice.
The backside of that, and I think what kind of helped me in my, you know, preparation for transitioning into that supervisor role was the amount that you learn from working with these other agencies. And then on top of that, just doing the job that we had to do, it gives you that benefit to where no matter what call you kind of go to, whether it be, you know, a 459 or a burglary in progress or an active shooter, you know, you generally have these tools in your tool bag now to where you're like, okay, I've been through some pretty chaotic shit and I feel comfortable. So, you know, whereas, as you know, and let's just say a newer cop, he comes in and, you know, it's an active shooter, which we talked about in that first episode, man, I was a brand new cop, right? And we're newer. And yeah. That incident back then, like, I remember specifically thinking on my way up there, like, God, I hope this dude's down by the time I get there. And then on the flip side of that, the other half of my brain was all, no, fuck that. I'm going to be the guy that goes and puts this dude down.
Right.
Like,
right.
You think you can come in here and just start shooting folks and get away with it? No, that ain't going to happen. You know? Right. And so now though, in comparison, you know, we have, you know, an incident pop off or something like that. And I'm like, cool, this is where I do good at. Like, you send me to a report call, I'm probably, you know, not going to be the most crazy good dude for, you know, investigating some type of, let's just say a sex crime. Right. But on the flip side, you give me something that's chaotic and there's a million moving parts and all that, I'm like,
you're calm.
This is where I'm ready to really get to work.
Right. That's your wheelhouse. Now that's kind of where you've established a specialty. And, mm-hmm. and everybody, you know, there are guys, I worked with a guy that wasn't great to work patrol with, but as soon as they moved him into financial crimes, when you had a financial crime that you know, took the initial report on and were not geared to investigate it, he was happy to do it, happy to take it. He could solve those things. That was his bread and butter. And that's, you know, that's something you won't know until you actually get on the job and start to test your talents. It always cracks me up how many people are like, I don't want to be a cop. I just want to be a detective.
Right. Right. Which, I mean, and what's even crazier is like people that are on the job say the same shit. Like,
right, right.
You know, newer people are like, oh yeah, I'm just here because I want to, you know, I want to work dope. And then, you know, I mean, man, I feel like I had that mentality. You know what I mean? Like I came in and I was like, hey, I just want to work dope. Like, that looks badass to me. That's where I want right. to go. You know, and then,
and it is, just for the record, dope is the coolest job in law enforcement.
Oh, 100%.
Except in California when it's basically legal.
That's true. That's true too.
It's very difficult. A lot of agencies they're scrapping a lot of their dope teams and their skeleton crews, and basically they're just using them for compliance on dispensaries. That's basically what it is.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, depending on where you're at. I mean, we're still pretty active in our side of it, but there is definitely that, whether people want to admit it or not, there is that mindset and everybody's got it in the back of their head, at least, that, you know, we're out here doing warrant services and things like that, that we could not come home from. And then at the end of the day, people, you know, you got to stop and think about it. And you're like, we're giving this dude a ticket.
You know,
what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah. Man. Serving a warrant to write somebody a ticket seems like the most insane, idiotic thing in the world. And honestly, I it's not worth it. Like, you look at, I was talking to John, and you know, when I have permission, I'll share what we were talking about. But you know, I was talking to John just yesterday, and we were having the conversation about, there comes a point at which you look at the stuff you're doing and the risk versus reward, and you say, yeah, why would I bother risking X when the only thing I'm going to get out of it is nothing. You know, like, it's, I'm not making any good. I'm not making a difference. That's one of the most disheartening things. So yeah, I get what you're saying. Serving a warrant to write somebody a ticket is not, dude, I could just go pull a car over and get the same stat.
Yeah. Well, and the crazy thing too is like when I started to really start prepping for this new gig I'm in and start learning some things, like I really started to focus on leadership, and I read multiple books, by this guy named Jocko Willink. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with him. He's a Navy SEAL.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We know Jocko. We got into Podcast Magazine's top 25 veteran hosted podcasts on the same list as Chuck or Jocko. Oh, wow. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So man, I learned a lot from kind of his ideology of dealing with the chaos that they obviously went through overseas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you bring a lot of those leadership principles back, you know, I had multiple months where I had already started prepping and learning about all this stuff, but I was still just a detective in my unit doing our thing. But it kind of transpired into that, you know, changing my mindset, because like when I first got into this unit as a detective, I was like, yeah, bro, I don't give a fuck. You got a warrant, you're going to jail. Like it's game on. And then, you know, just as with anything, you start to get some experience under your belt, you start to see what can go wrong, what did go wrong, etc. And so like I remember not too many months ago, we were set up on this dude that we had information that he had a gun, and we were trying to find him through all of our different resources and all that. We're set up on him, wait for him to come outside so that we could just confirm that he's where we thought he was and go with the warrants and everything else. And so I'm sitting there, and I had a probation partner with me at the time. And they're like, well, I mean, ultimately this is because of COVID, this is just going to be a side out. And I'm like,
right,
wait a second, pump the brakes. Like I'm about to call in 15, 20 dudes to go hit this house with a guy that allegedly could possibly have a gun. And if we had that, he did have the gun, then that's one thing. Like we'll take him to jail for that. But if it's strictly for just this warrant and he's out, or he's going to just get cited out and released, why in the world would I go request 15, 20 guys to come kick down a door and expose us to that? Right. And I think that's kind of transpiring across law enforcement as a whole right now.
I was just going to say that.
It is. It is. It definitely is. Especially that risk versus reward type of thing. When you look at pursuits and stuff like that, it's like property crime versus endangering the public safety. And it's like, you all want to go and chase the bad guy. You want to go and you get that pursuit because it's fun. It's great. Your adrenaline goes up, but at the end of the day, it's a property crime. Unless there's some extenuating circumstances, like it's a 187 suspect, you know, or something
murder
else,
for those of you outside of California,
right? Other than just a stolen vehicle, you know, some G ride. I mean, then you're kind of like in that risk versus reward. Like I want to go chase it, but at the same time, I could get into a wreck. I could hurt myself. And if I hurt someone else because of that, as a result, I could possibly be held and liable for some BS, you know, just in the way everything's going right now in the state and in the country.
Right. Well, and I mean, the hardest part about our job right now is everybody that I know that puts on that uniform and wears that badge and carries that gun is out there for one reason and one reason only. And that is to try and make whatever community they're serving better. The problem is none of us signed up in this job to get killed. None of us signed up for this job to get hurt. And it seems as of late that every time anybody does anything on the law enforcement side, does anything to defend themselves, okay, they get hung out to dry. And it's not a department issue. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
It's not a department issue. You know, there's departments that have their guys' backs 100%. It's, in my opinion, I think it's a media issue. I think it's a cultural issue. And, you know, you have these circumstances right now where no matter what the circumstances were, as far as what the criminal did that caused us to get into that use of force or to deploy, you know, less lethal or lethal, whatever it may be, no one ever talks about that. That doesn't matter anymore. Now it's strictly cop did this, cop shouldn't have done this, however it played out. And now that cop's getting hung to dry. And I'm not saying that, you know, some of these high profile cases, you know, especially the ones that we've seen over the last couple of years, that that stands for all of that also. I'm not even going to go down that rabbit hole. But as a whole in law enforcement right now, the hats that are required of us to wear, I mean, this whole push of defunding the police and all the cops are bad and everybody's racist and all this nonsense is exactly that. It's nothing more than nonsense.
Right.
Okay. I argue all the time that, you know, systematic racism does not occur, especially out here in the West Coast. I can't speak for everywhere else, but this whole idea of systematic racism, in my opinion, doesn't occur. And this whole push for defunding the police is literally the dumbest thing I could ever think of, because again, we are tasked from the public to be law enforcement officers, mental health crisis psychologists, social workers, you name it, they want us to handle it for them, right? But what are we trained for? Realistically, we're 99% of the time we are trained as law enforcement officers. And yeah, we can go do an 8-hour class here or there for crisis intervention, but that's not true training. That's not going to college for 4 years and getting your doctorate or, you know, becoming a psychologist, something like that. So realistically, this whole push of, oh, we need to defund the police. Well, that's just idiotic. You're asking so much of us. You need to fund us more and give us the tools if you want us to be successful and you want to see the change.
You know, it's crazy. Start funding us. Yeah. And you know, it's crazy. The whole push during that whole defunding the police thing, which is still going on with the whole, well, we need to get social workers out there. Okay. Well, I've been on calls with social workers where they had to call first and they call us. And generally it's for a 5150. For those of you who don't know, it's a mental.
Yeah, it's not just a Van Halen album. It's somebody who's a danger to themselves or others and needs to be put on a 72-hour hold.
Right. Or an application for a 72-hour hold, because a doctor ultimately has the ultimate say. But here's the thing. They get that call first, and a lot of times it's a PET team or whatever through the county, and they call us and they're like, well, we can't get the person to go. I'm like, okay. And we get there, I'm like, well, we can't take the person. The person doesn't meet the criteria. Yeah, the person might be crazy, but they're not a danger to themselves or others right now.
Being crazy isn't a crime.
It's not a crime. And then
refusing to take your meds isn't a crime. Being an asshole isn't a crime. Like, there are so many things we get called for, as William said, that aren't crimes. So yeah.
And I've seen cops do better jobs than social workers when it comes to 5150s and these mental patients, and we get them the help that they need. And oftentimes they try to hurt us or they try to hurt other people. And if you have some sort of social worker trying to get out there and do it, they're not going to be able to do the job. They're going to get hurt themselves, or they're going to cause somebody else to get hurt. And then, you know, or we're just there for, you know, when it comes to like DCFS stuff, we sit there and we give protection. But then half the times we have to chime in and calm down the situation, handle the situation, then to allow the social worker to talk. And I'm like, well, if they were just here by themselves, they'd be screwed.
Yeah.
You know? So this whole defunding is ridiculous. I agree.
So now here's kind of my thought. It is ridiculous, but here's what I'll tell you about that. My thought is now, and I've reached this kind of Zen place about it, I guess. You get what you pay for, right? So if the public wants to defund the police, then they were the ones who asked us to clean up the city streets and keep them safe in the first place. You go back to 1860, 1870, 1880 in, you know, anywhere west of the Mississippi, you know, Dodge City, Tombstone, all these places that are famous, you know, having Boot Hill or, you know, being shot in a saloon over a game of cards, all that crap. Guess what? That was because it was Wild West, lawless. Just like, there was like a marshal for the territory. There might be a sheriff. He might be corrupt. He might not, you know, he might be competent. He might not. You never knew. It wasn't professional. It was hodgepodge. It was, you know, you move somewhere and you hope that it was a good, well, that's what you're getting now. That's what you're asking for now. And all the people that are still like, they still want peaceful communities where things are kept clean and police are supported and they do their jobs, they're going to leave. They're just going to leave. And you take me as a case in point, you're just going to get the hell out and go somewhere where cops aren't defunded and the cities are clean and orderly and order is kept. And the rest of those cities are just going to become war zones. And so to those people who are asking to defund the police, you are asking for war zones. You are asking to bring the Wild Wild West back. And what's ironic is that most of the people that call to defund the police are actually also anti-gun type people. So guess what? When you don't have cops with guns and you don't have a gun and some bad guy shows up at your door, I ain't even going to cry. I'm just going to be like, well, tough shit.
Put it this way, and I'm sure, Will, I'm sure you've dealt with the same thing. We've had numerous cases where we've got a parolee, a felon, who's out, and they're not allowed to own a gun. Yet we arrest them, and
they're not even allowed to own a BB gun.
No, and they have ARs, they have Glocks, they have subcompacts, they have revolvers, and a bunch of stolen shit. I mean, and you look at all that, and you ask the officers if it's not yourself and it's other your other partners, and you go, "Hey, was any of that shit registered?" And they go, "No, half of it was manufactured themselves, mm-hmm. or right. stolen,
right.
or stolen from an unregistered gun that from back in the day before you had to register your guns, and they stole them, but there's no trace on it because the person didn't ever have it registered or they right. never had it insured. So they're just these guns floating around, and you ask to defund the police or you ask to you know, get rid of guns. And you're not going to get rid of guns. I mean, they're still out there. You have felons who are not allowed to own weapons, yet they're carrying more firepower than your average patrol cop.
Yep. So have fun with that.
Yeah, it's a recipe for disaster. It's interesting. I know we were just talking a minute ago about Jocko, and you know, Jocko has his own deal too with the podcast going, but kind of tie into this. I was recently listening to one of them, and he had this guy that he was on the teams with from Poland. And to make a long story short, he grew up in Poland in the 60s, I believe, when it was
It was an Eastern Bloc. Yeah,
it was a communist regime, and it was interesting because he actually went to prison for a few years for standing up to the communist deal. And as he's describing kind of his story the other day about how life was, what it was like in Poland in the 60s, it was insane because it was literally what we are living today. Yep. And I'm not comparing, you know, it being, you know, just the general principles, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, well, you're not allowed to talk about wanting to speak English. You're going to learn Russian. You're not allowed to speak English because the communists say you can't. And if you do that, right. you're going to go to jail. And right. I remember like specifically at one point that he talked about how whatever, you know, agency or whatever that handled the communist side of that, they went to his mom's house because in school he was like, I don't want to learn fucking Russian. I want to learn English or, you know, something else. And then they saw that as anti-communism. And they went to his mom's house and said, if your kid ever says anything like this again, we're going to take your kids away from you because you're teaching them anti-communist deals.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
And you know, you look at that today, right? Where we're in a society where if you don't go with mainstream media and agenda, then what happens? Twitter deletes your posts. Instagram deletes your posts. You know, Facebook.
Well, how about mothers that allow their kids to go play on the playground in the common area of their apartment complex, and they can see them out their kitchen window of their apartment, but you know, they're not down there with them. And so they get the cops called on them, and the cops come out and threaten to take their kids away if they let the 6-year-old and the 8-year-old play on the playground without the mom sitting 2 feet away, even though the mom's only 50 feet away and can see them the whole time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's insane. It's just insane.
Yeah.
Well, we are running
backwards right now.
Well, we're running out of time, and I had a request through Instagram. So normally we give our guests, and I've done this a little bit more and more as these things come in. But normally we give our guests the opportunity to dedicate the episode to whomever they like. However, in this case, we had a special request for Officer Philip Meacham of the Hopkinsville Police Department in Kentucky. His end of watch was it was March 29th, 2018, and when I looked it up, it got sent to us. Right around the anniversary of the end of watch date. What I looked it up was this guy was off duty and got pulled over by someone who was impersonating a cop and got in a gun battle with him and was shot and killed, and a pursuit ensued. And this, yeah. So, you know, Officer Philip Meacham of the Hopkinsville Police Department, end of watch, March 29th, 2018, rest easy, brother. We've got it from here. So William, do you have anything as we close out? I know we kind of talked a lot about your case, but we also talked a lot about how futile some of that stuff is in this day and age, especially depending on where you're involved in law enforcement at. And for those of you that live in parts of the country where this isn't happening, count yourself lucky and stay on guard, because stand by. If they try it, it could just as easily come to your neighborhood. So do you have anything else you wanted to mention?
I would just say for all of the cops that are listening to this right now, just stay strong, hold that line. This will pass. Stay motivated. We have a job to do. Just make sure we all go home at the end of the day and keep you and your partner safe. And ultimately, just make good decisions. And
right now, the only people you can depend on is each other.
Yeah, absolutely. So keep fighting that fight.
And where can people find your wives apparel company if they want to buy a shirt and make a difference with a charitable cause?
So on Instagram, you can go to Babes and Bullets Co. And then the website is www.babesandbulletsco.com.
Nice.
Very cool. Chuck, do you have anything?
No, nothing. Just we were saying, keep your heads up, stay strong, hold that line. It may get a little bit rough, but you got to keep pushing.
Yeah. And that's that, there's going to come a tipping point, and, stay frosty until that moment, and do your best to protect your family and do your best to protect your community, and, keep your head down and stay out of the bullshit, because that's what's going to suck you in like quicksand.
Yeah. And don't ever get complacent. So, keep that fucking head on a swivel for sure.
Yeah, complacency kills. I talked to a guy today, and we were discussing, because in the beautiful state of Idaho, it's constitutional carry. So he's a civilian, but he's carrying. And we were discussing how he's like, yeah, well, when I'm at this kind of a place or at this kind of a place, I'm at condition white. Cooper and so he's kind of he's cool. He's showing me that he knows. Like he's got a mindset. He's had a little bit of training, or at least he's read an internet article or two about mindset. But he says, when I'm at home, or if I'm at church, or I'm this or I'm that, I'll condition white. And then there, other places I'm at condition yellow. And I'm like, bro, the only time I'm at condition white is if I'm on an operating table under anesthetic. Like even when I sleep, I'm at off white, it's one of those things that we're never going to, and it came up because I had mentioned, I said, oh yeah, I was working out in my shorts. I don't know if you saw them, because we were at the gym at the same time. And he's like, no, I don't notice that kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh, I notice everything. I notice people's footwear. I notice their clothing. I notice their attire. I notice if there are bulges in their pockets or in their waistbands. That's what we do, right? That's how we keep ourselves safe. And so we're reminding you, sheepdogs out there, stay safe, keep vigilant, keep your head on a swivel, stay frosty, pick your idiom, but whatever you do,
piggyback on that real quick.
Yeah.
Also, sheepdog or not, that for civilians especially right now, vigilance is key for anybody.
Oh, yeah.
I don't care if you're a fireman, you're a cop, you're a banker, right now in today's day and age, I cannot even tell you the amount of people that are out on the street that are very bad people that are in possession of things they're not supposed to have. And that can literally pop off anywhere at any time. I don't care where you live. I don't care what city you're in. It can happen anywhere.
Yep.
So be vigilant and have a plan.
Yep. Exactly. Well, I think that's a good place to end it for this week. And so I just wanted to say, until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.